Pastor Bertrand L. Comparé.
Tonight I thought I'd start in on the topic, which I probably can't completely finish in the one evening, the topic of the economic laws of God. Now, we've sketched briefly the general scheme of the laws of God before. We've seen how well adapted God's criminal law is to really suppressing crime, where our present American law not only doesn't suppress it, it actively encourages it. Now, when it comes to the economic laws, we're going to find that the laws of God are totally superior to anything that we have. God's wisdom devised a perfect economic system. Under that system, there would be no immense billion-dollar fortunes accumulated, that's true. Although a reasonable degree of wealth was very possible, someone like Henry Ford, who really earned a vast amount of money because he gave the public a full dollar's value for every dollar they paid for his own Model T, someone like that would become quite wealthy indeed. Not up in the class with the Rockefellers, perhaps, but certainly enough to assure him all the luxury that one reasonably could want. But there would be no poverty. There would be a general high standard of living. Now, I don't have to tell you how far we've departed from that. All you need do is look around you at the things that occur every day and the people you know, and you see how far we've fallen below that standard. Now, it's true that God's economic law originated among a people who were living in an agricultural civilization primarily. I don't mean that they were all farmers or they didn't have highly developed arts and manufacturing skills, but the main income of the nation was from agriculture. On the other hand, the laws, as God laid them out, would work just as effectively under our present manufacturing and technological system as they did in the days when most of the people were on the farm. Now, as you know, of course, business has to be transacted by an agreement between a buyer and a seller, or whatever they are doing, and we give the name of a contract to that. And from time immemorial, people have had to make agreements on what transactions they were making. At the earliest times that are clearly reflected in the Bible, the standard apparently was a loose one in actual practice. That is, you could agree to do something and then change your mind if you wanted to, and the other fellow couldn't hold you to it. If it was to be a contract that you must fulfill, you had to swear to it in addition. For example, Genesis 21, verses 22 to 23. Abraham had been living in one of the pagan kingdoms, and they had treated him all right. The king noted that God was favoring Abraham, who was becoming wealthy and powerful, and the king wanted to be sure that when Abraham left, he wouldn't turn into an enemy. So we read this. And it came to pass that at that time, that Abimelech and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, spake unto Abraham, saying, God is with thee in all that thou doest. Now therefore swear to me here by God that thou wilt not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my son's son, but according to the kindness that I have done unto thee, thou shalt do unto me and to the land wherein thou hast sojourned. Well, a double standard like that definitely is based upon trickery, isn't it? I reserve the right to cheat you unless I swear that I won't. So, you note that Jesus Christ condemned taking oath to do something as being evil because it recognized the existence of a double standard, one of which didn't require honesty. Matthew 5, verses 33 to 37. He said, but let your communication be yea, yea, or nay, nay, for whatever is more than these comes of evil. If you have to say more than yes, I will, or no, I won't, it is based upon evil. Now, written contracts. Courts have long ago observed that after time has passed, and especially after circumstances have changed, so that the exact words of the contract may make a difference. If they're this way, why, you gain a lot of money, and if they're that way, you lose a lot of money, that human memory becomes notoriously slippery. After you have seen which way will profit you, you tend to remember the agreement as being in your favor, maybe a little more than it really was. So the need for written contracts developed pretty early. Probably the earliest written contract mentioned in the Bible, going back, oh, a little earlier than 1000 B.C., Solomon sent a written message to Hiram, the king of Tyre. He said, I want to build a temple, and I want to buy from you some of the building materials. I want great timbers from the cedars of Lebanon, and I want to hire from you some very skilled workmen to help my workmen put it up. And we read that Hiram sent back a written contract agreeing that he would do it. He would furnish the timber and the workmen and all that for the price that Solomon had offered. That's 2 Chronicles 3, verses 3 to 16. Now, we know that in the Near East and Middle East, written contracts were very ancient. Our museums today, I believe the particular tablet I'm speaking of is in the Yale University Museum, but we have contract clay tablets going back to at least 5000 B.C. and probably earlier. So the idea of doing business in a business-like way is no new invention. Then you read in Jeremiah 32, verses 6 to 16, that Jeremiah had the right to redeem a field of land which a relative of his had sold. And so he did exercise that right to redeem it for him, paid out the money, and got the deed to it. Now, we have trouble today, you know, not only with mislaying contracts, we have trouble sometimes with the other fellow's copy of the contract having something on it that we don't think was there when we signed it. Well, the ancients ran into that too. Now, you read in Jeremiah that the deed was signed, completely written and signed in duplicate on parchment. One was left open, and the other was sealed in an earthen jar. Now, you remember reading a few years ago about the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls. These were written on sheepskin parchment and sealed up in earthen jars, a tightly stoppered mouth to the jar, and the little crack around the stopper sealed with beeswax so that no air could get in. And those Dead Sea Scrolls date from approximately 200 B.C. And here they are, and with a bit of care, they could be opened and deciphered today. So what you read about in Jeremiah is the same thing as those Dead Sea Scrolls. Now here was a copy of the deed in possession of the buyer. And in case he was tempted to add a few acres to what was the description in the deed, there was the other copy of it sealed up so it was tamper-proof. And you need only break open that jar and get it out and see what was in the original contract. Well, they had that same problem back in Babylonia, too. Using that term Babylonia to take in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, going back before the time when the city of Babylon was most important. Back there, they had no materials from which to make paper, as far as we know. But they did have a beautiful clay silt that was the finest known anywhere in the world for making tile and pottery and that sort of thing. So their contracts were made on a clay tablet, written while the clay was moist and soft. Then it was dried, burned in the kiln until, oh, it would be like the china dishes on your shelf, and would last for countless thousands of years. Well, even that wasn't proof against forgery. Although we know they did take some precautions, our museums have specimens where the two parties took hold of this tablet and made their thumbprint. One man would make his thumbprint in, let's say, the upper left-hand corner, and the other man would put his thumbprint in the lower right-hand corner. So even the idea of fingerprinting is not totally new. But suppose you have a clay tablet with a contract written on it, and it's been burned in the kiln. But even so, a little careful work with a good sharp chisel or file can cut in a few more letters than were originally there. So the forger could do his work even in those days. But they had an answer to that. They made a clay tile, put their contract on it, signed it, dried it, burned it hard in the kiln. Then they wrapped a coating of soft, wet clay around that, repeated their contract word for word on this outer coating of clay, dried it, burned it hard, and now that was tamper-proof. Because if anybody disputed the accuracy of the writing on the outer coating, all you needed to do was break it off, and the inner tile, of course, had been protected, totally tamper-proof. So, smart ideas aren't altogether new. Well, rascals have always existed, but the laws of God were designed to hinder their operation. Now, the Bible is very clear that in all dealings, complete good faith was required. There are many places in Scripture which speak of God's punishment on those who deal unfairly with others. For example, Proverbs 12, verse 22, Ecclesiasticus 5, verse 8, 29, verse 3, and 40, verse 12. By the way, note that is not Ecclesiastes, which is in your Bible, but Ecclesiasticus, which is in the Apocrypha. Then in Leviticus 19, chapter 19, verses 11 and 13, it's summed up concisely and beautifully. You shall not steal, neither deal falsely, neither lie to one another. Thou shalt not defraud thy neighbor, neither rob him. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with thee all night until the morning. Now, back in those days, the laborer wasn't paid enough that he could afford to wait till he got his monthly paycheck. To feed his family, he needed to get his wages daily. And the Bible is very strict in its denunciation of the employer who said, well, I'll pay you tomorrow. It says that if you do that, the laborer thus delayed in getting his wages will cry unto me, and it will be sin unto you. So God was strict about that. See also James 5, verse 4, and Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 to 15. Now, there are different ways in which one man's property can come into the possession of another. You can borrow it, or it can be left with you for safekeeping, or you can find it. Now, what about these cases? Well, the Bible had strict rules on this. Exodus 22, verses 7 to 13. If a man deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and it be stolen out of the man's house, if the thief be found, let him pay double. And I might interrupt here to mention that under some circumstances, the thief not only had to give back double what he stole, but sometimes even four or five times as much. Now, why do people steal? To make a profit, of course. And if you pay back from double to five times as much, why, all the fun's gone out of it, isn't it? And there wasn't any probation. Now, we don't impress the lesson on the criminal under today's system of justice. In the first place, there's a long delay between the crime and the punishment. And the sob sisters in the newspaper and the professional revolutionaries all assure the criminal that he is a terribly wronged, innocent man. Well, if he doesn't have the money to put up for bail, he stays in jail some months until his trial comes up without anybody knowing yet whether he's really guilty or innocent. But then when his trial comes up, by that time he's forgotten the connection between what he did and what may happen to him. If he does get a jail sentence, he's lost the connection in his mind and he thinks he's being picked on. And the probabilities are that all he gets is probation anyway. And if you think that the youth don't coldly calculate upon the certainty of probation, you're just ignorant. I remember in my own high school days, in my junior year in high school, one of the members of the junior class had stolen 34 automobiles for joyriding, left some of them wrecked in the ditch, and of course he got the automatic, well, you poor boy, I'll give you probation. And that was quite a topic of discussion in our class, and believe me, I heard many of the kids say, well, why shouldn't I do the same? I'll get off the same as he did. The lesson is not lost upon them. People don't suddenly start to think when they reach their 21st or now their 18th birthday. They're doing thinking a lot earlier than that, even if their thinking isn't always straight. So we need a law which will guide them. Well, if the thief be found, let him pay double. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges, to see whether he has put his hands unto his neighbor's goods. For all manner of trespass, and the Bible uses that term trespass in the larger sense, you have wrongly invaded your neighbor's rights in some matter. It's not merely if you go on his land without permission, but if you have done him any wrong, it's a trespass. For all manner of trespass, whether it be for ox, for ass, for sheep, for raiment or for any manner of lost thing, which another challenges to be his. The cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. If a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep, by that means to keep, for safekeeping, to be returned later, and it die or be hurt or driven away, no man seeing it, then shall an oath of Yahweh be between them both, that he has not put his hand unto his neighbor's good, and the owner shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good. And if it be stolen from him, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. Now, why the difference? Well, the herds and flocks were never turned loose on vast ranges like in our old Wild West days, when the owner of the cattle ranch never saw his cattle except once a year at branding time. All kinds of sheep and cattle and so on were under the care of herdsmen who were constantly guarding them, and they were supposed to be on the alert and prevent anyone from stealing them, or at least get a look at the thief if they couldn't stop him, so they could identify him. Not having done that, it was a negligent loss of the neighbor's goods, and for that negligence he should pay. And if it be torn in pieces, that is, by some wild beast's attack, then let him bring it for witness, and he shall not make good that which was torn. Now your shepherd could keep watch on things so that a thief would not come around trying to steal lest he be recognized. But your shepherd might not be able to drive off a wolf pack that attacked. So, if it was lost by attack by wild animals, it presumably was not by negligence, and therefore the law simply remained where it fell. Then Exodus 22, verses 14 to 15. And if a man borrow anything of his neighbor, and it be hurt or die, the owner thereof being not with it, he shall surely make it good. You go to your neighbor and say, I've got some plowing to do, and I don't have enough oxen to do the necessary plowing. I want to borrow a team of oxen from you. So he lends them to you, and you take his oxen to plow your field. Well, it's up to you to get them back to him in as good condition as when they were loaned, or else you pay the difference. But now suppose you go to your neighbor and say, I need help plowing the field. I'll hire you and your team of oxen to come and plow with my servants. So the neighbor brings his own team of oxen, and he himself is in charge of them while they're plowing. And something happens to them. Well, now that's something different. If the owner thereof be with it, he shall not make it good. If it be an hired thing, it came for his hire. You had offered to pay him so much to bring his team of oxen and plow for a day on your field, and it was therefore up to him, having his own oxen and his own charge, to take care of them. And if he didn't do it, it was his loss. Now, what about the penalties for fraud? Now, remember, this could come up in one of two different ways. A man could be caught in his fraud and dragged into court to be punished as a thief or attempted thief. Or he has escaped detection so far, but he realizes he's been guilty of a sin. And they were taught quite plainly the penalty of sin is death. So he goes to the temple to offer his sin offering and be relieved of his sin for doing this. Not having made good. Does he get away with it? Not one bit. Leviticus 6, verses 2 to 5. If a soul sinned and commit a trespass against Yahweh, and lie unto his neighbor in that which was delivered him to keep, or in fellowship, or in a thing taken away by violence, or hath deceived his neighbor, or hath found that which was lost, and lies concerning it, and swears falsely, in any or all of these that a man does, sinning therein, then it shall be, because he has sinned and is guilty, that he shall restore that which he took violently away, or the thing which he has deceitfully gotten, or that which was delivered to him to keep, or the lost thing which he found, or all that about which he has sworn falsely. He shall even restore it in the principal sum, and shall add the fifth part more thereto, and give it to him to whom it appertains in the day of his trespass offering. Now, true, he started out cheating his neighbor. He has repented of it. He makes a voluntary restoration, and he gets by with a 20% penalty. If he goes into court, the minimum would be he would have to restore double. It might be, in some instances, 4 or 5 times what he stole. So the law is fair as well as just. The man who did let his foot slip but thinks better of it and wants to do right, he doesn't get off scot-free, but he does get off with a minimum penalty. The man who has to be dragged kicking and screaming into court, he really gets the works. And you can bet that people saw the point of that. Now, what about loans? We've spoken of borrowing of things, but now what about borrowing money? Well, the law requires that a man make every honest effort to repay his honest debts. For example, Psalm 37:21, the wicked borroweth and payeth not again. Ecclesiasticus 4:31, let not thine hand be stretched out to receive, and shut when thou shouldest repay. Simple honesty. Again, Ecclesiasticus 29:4-7, many, when a thing was lent to them, reckoned it to be found, and put them to trouble that helped them. Many, therefore, have refused to lend for other men's ill dealing, fearing to be defrauded. So, what we're going to be studying about the way God arranged for cancellation of debt was not an encouragement of the professional deadbeat. The debtor had to be honest to the extent that he had the ability. Now, what if he's run up against misfortune and he does not have the ability? Well, God had a correct answer to that problem also. Deuteronomy 15:7-10 points out that you should lend to the poor even when you know he is not able to repay. Now, if this poor man comes to you and says, there's a great bargain on Cadillacs right now, and lend me enough money to buy one of those, why, of course, you were under no obligation to do so. But if he and his family were in danger of going hungry, then lending him something to eat for a few days till he could get a job, that was a different thing. Even though you knew that he himself would not be able to repay, it was still your obligation to do so. Deuteronomy 15:7-10. If there be among you a poor man of one of thy brethren within any of thy gates in thy land, which Yahweh thy God hath given thee, Thou shalt not harden thine heart, nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother, but thou shalt open thine hand wide unto him, and surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he lacketh. Beware that there be not a thought in thy wicked heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and thine eye be evil against thy poor brother, and thou givest him naught, and he cry unto Yahweh against thee, and it be sin unto thee. Thou shalt surely give unto him, and thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest him. Because for this thing Yahweh thy God shall bless thee in all thy work, and in all thou puttest thine hand unto. So, you are asked for a loan by somebody, and it looks as though he probably will be able to repay. So do you lend it to him at 10% interest? No. Interest, or usury, is absolutely forbidden in the Bible. Today, and indeed for some several hundred years, trying to get around that law of God, we have chosen to apply the word usury simply to what is considered an excessively high rate of interest. But according to the Bible, a billionth of 1% per million years is just as much usury as the pawnbroker's 42% a year. Usury, as the word is used in the Bible, is any payment made for the use of the thing loaned, whether it be money, or whether it be lending in food, or whatnot. Exodus 22, verse 23. If thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be unto him as a usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. And Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 to 20. Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Now note this distinction. Unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury, that Yahweh thy God may bless thee in all that thou settest thine hand to in the land whither thou goest to possess it. Now, in the first place, there were not supposed to be aliens among us. They don't come here for our benefit. They come here for their benefit. They want to make an extra profit out of living under the good conditions which our hard work, our loyalty to our God, make possible. And you are certainly under no moral obligation to help them be parasites upon you by lending without interest to them. But unto your fellow Israelite, no interest or usury at all. The early Christians continued to follow this rule. The church denounced it as a sin to take usury. And oh, well up into the tail end of the Middle Ages, the law against lending upon usury was enforced, except that the Jews were always allowed to get away with it. Why? Well, the king, of course, taxed his subjects mercilessly. But he and the hangers-on at his court were not satisfied with being well-clothed and well-fed and comfortable. They had to have their pastimes, gambling and that sort of thing. And the amount of money that could be gained by even extortionate taxation was often insufficient for all the dissipations of the king and his court. And so when he wanted some more money for something, and more taxes would probably bring about rebellion, he could borrow some money from the Jews. So in return, of course, he always allowed the Jews, when they loaned money to his people, to charge extortionately high rates of interest. You'll find that worked out all through the Middle Ages. Taking of interest or usury was first made legal in England in 1545 A.D. at a maximum rate of 10%. Now, until that time, suppose the ordinary Englishman, not the Jew, but the ordinary Englishman loaned money and charged interest. Well, the criminal law didn't have anything on the subject. Now, the church had its own courts, and people could be tried in the church courts for doing anything that the church considered sinful. But what could the church do? It convicted you of a sin, but it couldn't send you to jail or have you hanged. It could admonish you to do better. It could, if it came to the worst, excommunicate you. But even that threat didn't bother the usurers very much. But in an early Virginia case, 1736, the court was dealing with a matter of usury, and it gave an interesting historical review of the law on usury. And it said usury seems to have been always condemned by ancient laws in England, although a usurer was only punished by ecclesiastical censure until he died. But if it was found by a jury of 12 men after his death that he had died a usurer, he was compared to a thief. His goods were forfeited to the king and his lands escheated. Now, you need a little explanation of medieval English and European law. In England, from the time of William the Conqueror, the entire island belonged to the king. He was the owner of every square foot of soil in England. So he would parcel out a particular county to a particular baron who might have to pay him some tax for it, but more particularly, the baron had to furnish, any time the king wanted it, a certain number of trained and equipped soldiers. Remember that war was still the usual and natural condition of life in those days, because no ruler was contented with whatever lands he had. He always wanted to conquer his neighbors and absorb them into his kingdom. So if the king was not considering going out on a plundering expedition, he was having to defend his own land from somebody else's plundering expedition. So it was very important that he should be able to rely upon a trained and equipped army available on demand. So that baron would have lost his lands, his whole county, if he had not kept up and maintained armed forces to the required number. So many armored knights on horseback and so many of the poor peasantry armed with scythes and sickles and so on. After all, what's the fun of war if there isn't some helpless person you can slaughter? So that was the arrangement in those days. Now the baron, in turn, parceled out his county, a knight who had to keep himself equipped with armor, horse, and so forth. He would receive so much farmland. And this he would parcel out to tenants, some of whom would have to be ready to come as part of the armed forces on demand, and all of them would have to pay him rent. So when you got down to the man who finally lived on the land and farmed it, he didn't own it. He was a mere tenant. and he could lose his lease for various causes. So now we see what they did to the usurer if he hadn't repented, but at the time of his death was still engaged in usury. His personal property, all his household effects, horses and carriages, that sort of thing, was forfeited to the king. After all, the baron had no claim on that. All the baron had parceled out was the land. And when your right to land was forfeited and it went back to the baron from whom you got it, that forfeiture was called an escheat, E-S-C-H-E-A-T. So the lands were escheated to the baron or count or duke from whom they were held, and the personal property went to the king. Now, all this didn't arise from some sudden belated spasm of morality. It came from pure and simple greed equal to the usurers. But that was the only way they could make a profit out of him. And they could feel really quite highly moral in doing it. It's interesting to note that even the early Chinese and Hindu law forbade taking usury. This is an ancient principle. Now you lend money to somebody, and you may want some kind of security to make it a little more likely that he will repay you. Now, if you take some bit of personal property as security, as the pawnbroker does, that's a pledge. If you take his land as security, that's a mortgage. Now, it was only in recent times that you could have a chattel mortgage, letting the owner, the debtor, retain personal property in his possession, but giving to the creditor a right to foreclose on it. Because until comparatively recent times, it was very hard for them to separate the idea of simple possession from the idea of ownership. With land, they managed to do it. With personal property, why, that is a different sort of thing. But a good example of a pledge is when you have...